Lecture 21, Non-Justificatory Theodicies.
We've spent our last two sessions talking about some of the different bad things that happen in the world and the way in which skeptics and atheists have argued that the occurrence of those bad things implies or shows that there cannot be a designer of the world that deserves to be worshipped. There may well be a designer, but it would be a designer that is in some way flawed, and anything that is flawed would not be worthy of human devotion, worship, and the like. So we've been looking at the problem of evil and the implications that the occurrence of evil have in the minds of non-believers. What we're going to be doing today and for the next several sessions is to look at some different lines of rebuttal that can be presented to defuse the argument from evil in one way or another. And there are several different ways that that can be done. Some of the rebuttals to the problem of evil involve trying to show that the evils, while real and genuine and out there, are in one way or another justified. In one way or another, they are made all right because of some corollary hypothesis, some further argument that reconciles them and makes sense. We're going to be looking at those, what I call justificatory rebuttals to the problem of evil, next time. I want to begin today by looking at some rebuttals to the problem of evil that make no attempt to justify the evils that occur in the world at all. And there are several such non-justificatory theodicies. You'll remember the word theodicy is just a fancy label for an argument that is calculated to show that for one reason or another, in one way or another, what are called evils are not incompatible with the existence of the divine. Perhaps those things that we call evil, or those things that appear to us to be evil, those things that seem to be evil, perhaps they're not really evil at all. Perhaps not being evil at all, they don't call for any justification. Their occurrence does not entail any blame or responsibility for anyone. They're just perfectly okay. Now, how could that be? Well, one way it could be would be if something that we perceived as an evil or saw as an evil was something that we were simply misconstruing or miscategorizing, classifying in the wrong way. We didn't get it. For instance, some people have said that death is one of the greatest evils that we have to figure out and deal with. Others have said, but no, death is radically misunderstood by these folks. Death is just moving from one plane of being to another plane of being. It's just migrating from one way of being alive to another, and indeed better way of being alive. So when you talk about death and the grave and the worm and all of that kind of dark stuff, you're just misconstruing, you're misunderstanding, you're miscategorizing what's going on. Similarly, others have argued that illness and disease and all of the terrible conditions that beset not only humans but other life forms as well, that these are misconstruals or misunderstandings. There's not really any such thing as real illness. There's not really any such thing as real sickness or injury. It's all in the mind. It's all a misperception. It's all a matter of getting out of sync or out of harmony with the proper divine perspective on the way of things. And if we could just cure ourselves of these errors and these misconstruals and see the world aright, then we would realize everything is just fine. Now, I have to say, in the context of that line of argument, that even if getting really sick and dying are not bad because we misconstrue them, etc., then okay, getting sick and dying aren't going to be evils anymore, but what about our inbuilt penchant for misconstruing them in the first place? What about the fact that we're wired in such a way that we automatically construe breaking a leg, catching a dread disease, being run over by a train, and being translated to a higher plane of being right there on the tracks? We automatically construe and interpret that as, you know, really bad things. That's the way we're wired. That's the way we respond to things. And if nothing else is a glitch in the order of the world, one could argue that the very tendency to misconstrue is a glitch in its own right. I'll leave you to think about that, but there's one line of explaining evil literally by explaining it away. There's nothing to justify because there's nothing wrong. Now, a variation on that theme can also go this way. And this is for the musicians among you. Sometimes, picture yourself at a symphony orchestra, and you might notice that certain notes that are being played by certain instruments, if they're heard separately, if they're heard out of the context of the symphony, are not very attractive. Little contrapuntal lines, little grace notes, from my point of view, virtually anything that is played on the contrabassoon, these things are all fine in the context of the total symphonic experience, but isolated and set out by themselves, they are jarring and disturbing and not aesthetically pleasing at all. Now, that is the metaphor. What it's a metaphor for is the notion that maybe in the world, if we could step back and get the big picture or hear the world symphony in toto and intact, then all of these bits and pieces and parts of what is going on in the world, we might realize are okay once we hear them in situ, once they are in place, once they are in context. Now, there is so much that can be said in response to that line of thought, but let me say a couple of things at any rate. To me, at any rate, the most important thing that needs to be said about that line of thought is that it simply doesn't take the evils that occur in the world seriously enough. You know, watch an infant in Biafra, dying of starvation, rattled with parasites, in agony, ultimately in delirium and seizures, and then death. Watch that, watch it intensely and in focus, and try to say, this is a grace note on the Divine Symphony. It strikes me that if one really looks and looks hard at the conditions that are common in this world, then this line, that if we could just get the big picture, everything hangs together beautifully, this line is just shallow. The second thing I need to say about this, and I'm going to use the metaphor of the Divine Symphony. Suppose you went to that symphony, and you found your seat, and I'm thinking of a time I went to a Symphony of the Lyric in Baltimore when I was in college, and I could only afford a really, really cheap seat, and I was sitting down in the front, off to the side, maybe about 3 feet from the contrabassoon player, and that's all I could hear. It was an awful, awful experience, even though the pieces that they were doing were ones that I liked. Now, what's my point? From the standpoint of ethical monotheism, God wrote the symphony. God made the instruments. God is playing the instruments. God is the architect who designed the symphony hall. He is also the acoustical engineer that laid it out. He is also the ticket agent that sold you the ticket that you got. All responsibility, not only for the grace notes, all responsibility, including responsibility of the unfortunate perspective from which the grace notes are all you can hear, all of that goes back to one ultimate source, if the strict monotheist is correct. So it seems to me that this divine symphony, grace notes, if you could get the big picture, if you could hear it all together, that it just doesn't hang together and work very well. But I will leave it to you to think through. The next time something terrible happens in the world, you read about it in the newspaper, or if you're unfortunate enough that it happens to you or to someone dear to you, ask yourself, can I really deal with this as just misconstrual, miscategorization, a faulty, narrow perspective, or is there something more fundamentally going wrong here? A whole second line of response, an entirely different line of response, would be to say, okay, evils are real. They really are there, and they're really serious, and they're really important. But we don't have to justify them and show that God had some good reason for doing this. We don't have to justify them because they aren't God's doing at all. Whatever responsibility there is for them, it goes somewhere else. The ticket doesn't go to God, and so, as terrible as they may be, they're perfectly compatible with God's character, as perfect as it may be. Now, a couple of ways you can do this. One way, and it makes pretty good sense, and we're going to move on from that next time into a fairly extensive line of argument. One way is to point out that, after all, a lot of the bad things that happen in the world, really are directly the result of things that people do. And the ticket goes to the person who does them. You know, the killing fields was a terrible, terrible experience, but God wasn't responsible for the killing fields. Pol Pot was responsible for the killing fields. Send the bill to Pol Pot. Don't plague God with responsibility for that. And indeed, I've heard many a person say to blame God for that kind of thing is just blasphemy on its face. That poses a problem, however, because, of course, even if Pol Pot is responsible for the killing fields, somebody or something is responsible for Pol Pot. It's at that point that this argument needs to go into the direction of a theodicy in terms of free will, and that's the direction in which we will be taking it shortly. So I'm going to hang a signpost, a flag there, and say we will come back to that. Another problem with this line of thinking, however, besides the necessity to push the argument further, which we'll do, another problem is that surely, not all of the terrible things that happen in the world are directly the result of things that people do. Now, okay, Pol Pot is responsible for the killing fields, but who's responsible for tsetse flies and sleeping sickness? And who's responsible for pinworms? And who's responsible for screw flies? And so on and so on. Now, there are a couple of lines of argument that you can pursue there. One is to say that, well, actually, ultimately, all of these things are the result of human wrongdoing. It all goes back to Adam and Eve in the garden. It all goes back to the sin that was committed at the beginning in that mythical presentation of the origin of the world. And when Adam and Eve sinned, when they fell, the world fell with them. The world was corrupted by the sin and wrongdoing of people that were in it. And once the world was corrupted, then bad things started to happen in the world. But Bad things never happened in the world before Adam and Eve were naughty. The imagery behind that is beautifully captured in a painting that I'm sure that you have seen somewhere called The Peaceable Kingdom. And in the painting, The Peaceable Kingdom, you have the lion and the lamb side by side and so on. The only thing I want to say about this line of reasoning right this moment is just this. If all of the tooth and claw, it's a jungle out there qualities of the world, date only back to Adam's fall. In Adam's fall, we sin it all. If they date only back to then, and if in fact, before the fall, as legend would have it, all the animals were vegetarians and so on. It really is a dramatic shift. It's really incredible. Somewhere in there, somehow in the causal sequence of things, Adam and Eve doing what they did changed the dental structure of lions and tigers. And lions and tigers stopped having a mouthful of molars and started having a mouthful of incisors and canines. Truly, truly remarkable. What I'm trying to say is that if you want to pursue this line of reasoning, that all of the natural things that happen in the world that are terrible are the consequence of the human fall, you're buying into a very, very complicated redescription of history, a very, very complicated redescription of biological species history, and one that is not borne out in the fossil evidence. Okay, there's another possibility. Maybe there are other agents at work in the world besides people. Maybe when diseases strike and volcanoes erupt and bad things happen, and it fairly obviously isn't because I did it or you did it or somebody that we know did it, maybe it's because there is another order of beings out there that are, for their own reasons and in their own way, set on the target of making life miserable. Now, this could vary from demons and imps. I once saw a cover picture on the National Enquirer. It purported to be a photograph of an earthquake out on the West Coast, and a great fissure had opened in the middle of the street, and in the picture, there were demons and imps and so on crawling up out of the fissure in the street. It looked amazingly more like a drawing than a photograph to me, but who am I to say or to question the veracity of the press? But maybe there are other orders of beings out there. And if so, maybe they are the ones that are all the time messing up all the good things God has done, so that we have bad things in their place. That is a possibility, and it's a more serious possibility than a lot of people admit to. So we're going to be coming back to that one too. But let me flag a caution on this line of argument, whether we're talking about just imps or whether we're talking about, with capital letters, the dark side. When you begin to go that path, you are beginning to very, very seriously erode the notion of monotheism. You're beginning very, very seriously to erode the notion that the creator, designer, sustainer has aseity, is unlimited by anything external to itself, is uncontingent, is supreme, absolute, etc. You're inching towards a dualist view of the world. Inching in that direction. Now, there's nothing a priori wrong with dualism. At one point, three or four lectures away, I'm going to even suggest that dualism is more consistent on some issues than a single monotheistic stance can ever hope to be. So I don't want to say there's anything a priori wrong with dualism, but there is something a priori wrong with a monotheist buying a dualist view, unless and until a very, very interesting argument is worked out to show how it is that God remains absolute, supreme, unqualified, has aseity, uncontingent, not limited by anything external, and nevertheless is locked in a struggle with something that is outside of God and in conflict with God. That takes some doing, but it can be done. So, we could argue that all of the so-called evils in the world really aren't evils at all. They're okay. We're just misunderstanding them. We could argue, no, there really are some evils in the world and they really are pretty terrible, but don't blame them on God. Don't feel that we've got to reconcile them to God's goodwill because they don't come from God in the first place. They come from people, or maybe even they come from agencies other than people, but they certainly don't come from God, him or herself. Now, there's one last option on this non-justificatory approach, and it's the trickiest and the most difficult of the lot to get a handle on. So I want to deal with it slowly and carefully. The argument goes something like this. Evils don't need to be justified because they are, in one sense or another, somehow, for one reason or another, absolutely necessary. They are uneliminable. They are maybe logically necessary. And if they're logically necessary, if there's no option about it, if they're not there because someone or something chose for them to be there, and if they're logically necessary, if they are inevitable, then it has nothing to do with any choice anybody made. If they are logically necessary and inevitable, then they're not anybody's fault. Let me explore just for a moment the interplay between the notion of necessity and the notion of responsibility. And let me do it at a very mundane human kind of level. There's an interesting argument that goes on among psychologists over whether or not people are responsible for the things that they do. Whether it is appropriate, for instance, to punish someone for doing this, that, or the other that is damaging and antisocial and undesirable in various kinds of ways. And some psychologists say, yes, punishment is legitimate because it's with punishment that we hold people responsible for what they have done, and it's with punishment we recognize that they are autonomous, responsible agents. Other psychologists, like B.F. Skinner, the famous or infamous, depending upon your perspective, behavioral psychologist, and Watson behind him, Watson actually invented behaviorism, they say, no, no. Everything that a person does is simply the inevitable product of prior events, input-output, cause-effect, so that the fact that I'm delivering a lecture right now could be traced back to things that happened this morning, going over my notes the last time before I was due to make the lecture. That could go back to things that happened yesterday, last week, months ago, the making of a business arrangement to have these lectures filmed. That in turn goes back to certain predispositions and attitudes on my part that no doubt were conditioned into me in my childhood, and a strict behaviorist is going to press it back and back and back and back and back, and is going to argue, appealing to a kind of a Newtonian closed causal view of the world and the principle of sufficient reason one more time. Given all the history prior to today, what's happening today could not be anything other than what it is. It's inevitable. The die was cast the day I was born. Indeed, the die was cast by 1066. Now, it would be weird. It would be truly, truly weird to punish me for something that was in the pipeline and inevitable at the time of the Battle of Hastings. And that's exactly what the behaviorist determinists say about people. We shouldn't punish them because it's not their responsibility. It's the responsibility of history. It's the responsibility of everything that's happened so far. Now, it's perfectly all right. I have to add a quick footnote. It's perfectly all right to respond to the bad things people do. In fact, it's inevitable we're going to. That's causally determined as well. But it doesn't make sense to think of it as punishment for something for which they're responsible. It ought to be reaction on our part to things that are aversive as far as we are concerned. Now, so the notion that necessity disconnects responsibility is not something that I'm just bringing up in the context of philosophy of religion for divine purposes only. It is a commonplace notion in behavioral psychology and in any causal analysis of human behavior. What if, then, evil, in one way or another, is just strictly necessary? It's inevitable. The standard way to make this move is not to argue that it's causally necessary. It's to argue that it's logically necessary. The notion is often put this way, that there cannot be good without evil. So if there's going to be any good in the world at all, there has to be evil by way of contrast to bring it into focus, to enable us to see it, to enable us to draw the distinction. No good without evil, and very, very commonly, an analogy is used at that point, no good without evil, just like there are no mountains without valleys. Now, I'll give you the no mountains without valleys. Mountain and valley are what are called polar concepts. They are defined in terms of one another. And you can't have a mountain without having a valley, in contrast to which it is the mountain. Similarly, you can't have valleys without mountains. You could have a flat world, and you could have a flat world at whatever height you want it relative to some benchmark. So we could have a high world, maybe a thicker globe, in which we're further from the center or something of the sort. Or we could have a low one where the globe is very, very tiny and we're very close to the middle. But we're not going to have surface relief unless we have surface relief. And we're not going to have high points on the surface unless there are low points on the surface for the contrast. Polar concepts, inseparable. And to say, oh, it's terrible, terrible, God should have given us all mountains, God should not have given us valleys. Shame on God for giving us valleys. It ought to be all mountains. That wouldn't make any sense at all. Because even an omnipotent being could not give us just one without the other. They are polar. Okay? Now, the question, of course, and this is the question you need to think about. Are good and evil polar the way mountain and valley are polar? Many writers have suggested that they are. One writer in particular, St. Augustine, suggested in a slightly different language. He said evil is simply the absence or the privation of good. Take good away and evil is just the empty space that's left behind. I would suggest to you that they're not polar, that it would be perfectly logically coherent to have a world in which everything that happened was bad, or to have a world in which everything that happened was good. We might not notice it in the way that we do when there's so much contrast going on. But you don't have to have the one to define the other. They're perfectly easily definable, each of them, in their own right. Next time, we're going to move on beyond these non-justificatory moves into some theodicies that, quite frankly, I think, make a lot more sense.